Good to see everybody back again this evening. Appreciate you being here. Of course, you're not here just for me. You're here for the Word of God. You're here to worship the Lord and to encourage all the brethren as we come together, thinking upon spiritual things, thinking about our home above. Our lesson again this evening is on the concept or the point of the second offering, whether that is unauthorized or whether it's authorized. And viewing in particular Brian Yeager's statements and points concerning his view that it is unauthorized. As we pick up where we left off this morning, I want to point out the point or the illustration, if you will, that in order to sustain his point, Brian Yeager has read into the text in several cases and several scriptures in an attempt to bolster his point. In 1 Corinthians 11:33, he speaks of that, and he says, Paul instructed the brethren in Corinth to wait on each other before partaking. Now, when we look at that, what does the word wait mean in 1 Corinthians 11:33? Sometimes there are words that we use in common English, but in the Bible they may have some different meaning, or it might have a definition even to the word, both definition and context, that use it a particular way that we are not bringing across in our modern language. And I think that's being done here. He's using the idea of wait before we can partake as if, well, if we come Sunday morning and someone can't be there till an hour later, according to his statement, that means we could not partake until they came. If we must wait for all to come in the sense he's using, we couldn't partake until all who could come did come. Now, when we look at this and look in the context of 1 Corinthians 11:33, we want to ask the question, does wait mean all eat at the same time? Is that what it means? When we look at 1 Corinthians 11, it's very important to see context. Usually I start off with the definition of the word, and we'll get to that. But on this page, I want to show in the context how is the word used, first of all. Then we'll look at definition. We'll see something, I think, in harmony with this. First of all, we see that the Lord's Supper was perverted in a number of ways. He says in chapter 11, in verse 17 and 18, that they were taking the Lord's Supper in such an occasion or such a manner that they were creating divisions. Of course, they had problems like that at Corinth anyway. But in verse 17, he says, But in giving you this charge, I praise you not, that you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together in the church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and I partly believe it. And he goes on to talk about somewhat the divisions there. So obviously there was some kind of division, some schism, some factionalism coming on, to where there were groups that were in and groups that were out. That's what was going on at Corinth. Now, of course, that's not right. Paul says, I'm not going to write and praise you for that. That's not acceptable. He goes on to talk about, not only have you created divisions, but you've turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal. Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? Don't you have a place to fulfill the desire and needs of the flesh in that sense? Yes, you do. So why do you come together in this fashion, creating division, and making the spiritual meal into a common meal? And so he corrects that as well. Then he picks up again on this point in verse 21. Notice chapter 11 and verse 21, he says, For in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry, and another drunken. Now here he hits on both those things together, that they are taken before another. One is hungry. What does that tell you? Some got to partake later? No. They weren't making provision at all, even with a common meal, for those who had come late. They were excluding them in this context. That's what he means, you're taking before another. You're being selfish, and you're being so selfish, you're not even letting them have a share in it at all. And so he corrects their selfish divisions, he corrects their common meal misconception, and he corrects this sorry attitude that resulted in brethren not being received and fellowshipped, being excluded. You think about what the Lord died for and what this memorial represents. Should it, in fact, become the occasion which excludes brethren? Certainly not. This is what is supposed to be a reminder of what Christ has done, the very foundation for everything that we are. Now, it's not the only thing that's important when we come to worship. Prayer is just important. Singing and teaching and all these other things. I know some people will say, well, the most important part is the Lord's Supper. Now, I don't deny it's important. But I would say everything the Lord commands is equally important. God commanded every piece and every portion of our worship that is authorized for His reasons. And they are for our benefit as well as to honor and glorify Him. And so we cannot elevate one thing above another without becoming unbalanced in our perspective. Yes, the Lord's Supper is important, but rather than saying it's more important than everything else, just put everything up there on the same level. Everything God says is important. Now, when we look at the context of these selfish divisions, and that line down the side, let me fix that. But they are having these selfish divisions and excluding some. We see also that he goes and corrects these very problems in the text. And this is a very interesting thing. He talks about their selfish divisions in contrast by saying in chapter 11, 28-32, that the Lord's Supper is not to be something that you just sit there and be selfish about, but rather you to be judging yourself, considering how the Lord went to the cross and the things that He went through, remembering His body and His blood, and considering how your life is, judging yourself. And so you see the contrast. Selfishness, not considering your spiritual state, versus considering our spiritual state very carefully by the standard of what Jesus Christ has done. And so there's a great contrast pictured right here. He's answering their foolish and selfish divisions. He also answers the common meal by telling them, here's what the Lord revealed. And it was a memorial of the body and blood of Christ, not a common meal. Not just a general feast, much less a feast for just some of you while you exclude the others, but it's a spiritual meal, a spiritual memorial. That's why if we partake of just a piece of the bread and a piece of the fruit of the vine, it's not the quantity of the bread. I mean, we could prepare enough to where everybody had a big piece. That'd be perfectly scriptural too, as well as a larger cup. That'd be scriptural too. Typically, though, we understand that being a participant in it, even the small piece that we take and the small amount of juice we partake, is talking about remembering things in a spiritual way. Fellowship is being emphasized. Spiritual communion is being emphasized here. We also see in chapter 11, verse 33, here's where he hits on again this idea of correcting their excluding one another. In verse 33, after talking about the self-examination that should be going on, he says, wherefore, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait one for another. Now, when he says that word wait, or King James Version tarry, we have a common English definition. But in the context, what has been going on that he's answering? Division, exclusion, common meal. And he's answered the divisions, the selfishness, with the spiritual self-exam. He's answered the common meal with the spiritual memorial. Therefore, I would propose to you, he's answering the exclusion of some brethren, the exclusion from fellowship and participation by saying, wait for one another. I believe that this is talking about fellowship, not necessarily timing that we all have to take at the same time. Of course, that would be a way to fulfill it. In this context, they were eating in such a way so that they were excluding others, in that sense, taking before another. So when we look at the definition for the word wait, Vines, Thayer's, other Greek lexicons will tell you that this word means to receive, to accept. It's not a reference to a certain time table. It's reference to you don't do this in such a way that you exclude them. The idea is you look for it, expect them to come. That's the idea of this word. And so when Paul says, wait for one another, he is literally saying, you receive them. You look for them to come. You expect them to partake. This is why I would put forward the idea that we are not authorized to exclude anyone or to arrange things in such a way, even incidentally, so that we would not allow someone to partake. When the Lord has authorized them to partake, we have no right to arrange things so as to not allow them to partake. And so I would point this out as a reason why we need to be willing to offer the Lord's Supper. If, for example, Sunday evening, we concluded our services and all our worship was done, and then someone came in 10 minutes later, they had a flat tire. And they said, brethren, I know I missed all the services, but I would still like to fulfill the commandments of the Lord. Would you mind taking time? Say, 10 or 12 people had already left. Well, could we stop and say, with those who remain, come together and assemble again for them so they could fulfill the Lord's commandment? I believe we could. And I believe that would be perfectly scriptural. Because has the Lord commanded them to take the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week in an assembly? Yes, they have. If those that remain, some have left already, but those who remain, we have 2 or 3 or 4 or 20, assembled again on the first day of the week, would it be first day of the week assembly? Yes, it would. And so the command could still be fulfilled even in that situation. And I think that's exactly what Paul is saying. Instead of being selfish about it, in this context, they were, you need to be looking for them to come and being ready to accommodate them so that they can partake. And I believe that's the very point that Paul is talking about when he says wait for one another. It's not necessarily that we all take it the same moment, but it is the idea of reception, fellowship with one another. Now, that's my point. It's about spiritual fellowship. Yes, it means everyone must partake. It doesn't mean everyone partakes in the same moment or necessarily in the same assembly. And again, these things, sometimes concepts that we have may take time to digest. There might be something that I've missed somewhere that you have some consideration for, and we can talk about those things. But I believe that this is a valid point, that it is about fellowship. It's about accepting, receiving one another, and allowing everyone to do what the Lord has commanded them to do in the way that He has commanded us, authorized us to do it. Now, we also see in Acts chapter 20 that Brian Yeager makes another argument, and it was kind of interesting to me. I don't think I've ever heard anybody make this argument before, but he asserts in Acts 20, verse 11, that the Lord's Supper is being referred to in verse 11. Now, let's just turn over there and read that. And if you'll turn over there to Acts chapter 20, in verse 7, we'll start the context. He says, "And upon the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread." Now, can anyone doubt that that's the Lord's Supper? First day of the week's mentioned, obviously. That's an assembly coming on here. They gathered together to break bread. Paul discoursed with them. This is not a common meal. There's some preaching going on. Obviously, this is a religious assembly. So verse 7 is breaking of bread in the sense of the Lord's Supper. Then he goes on. Paul discoursed with them, intending to depart on the morrow, and prolonged his speech into midnight. And there were many lights in the upper chamber where we were gathered together. And there sat in the window a certain young man named Eutychus, borne down with deep sleep. And as Paul discoursed yet longer, being borne down by his sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. And Paul went down and fell on him, and embracing him said, Make ye no ado, for his life is in him. And when he was gone up, and had broken the bread, and eaten, and had talked with them a long while, even till break of day, so he departed, and they brought the lad alive, and were not a little comforted. Now, verse 7 obviously is the Lord's Supper. But we see that Mr. Yeager, we'll show a quote in just a second, asserts verse 11 is actually the eating of the Lord's Supper. That verse 7 was, well, they came together for this person for a purpose, and verse 11 is they actually did it then. Well, I don't believe that that is correct. I believe verse 11 is simply Paul having a common meal before he departed on his journey. And we'll show why. But he, responding to my statement on that regard, said this. He said, "Have you considered that Acts 20, verse 7 tells us what was going to happen while the actual events were concluded through verse 11? If verse 11 is a common meal with the brethren there, then such is not only authorized, but by example would be just as binding as verse 7. Have you considered that eating in verse 11 is partaking of the Lord's Supper?" Well, that's what he asserts about this passage. Well, let's look at that. If Acts 20 and verse 11 is the Lord's Supper, then do you realize that this would prove a second offering? What happened in Acts 20? They come together for the purpose of eating. They gathered on the first day for the purpose of eating, breaking bread. Then, as Paul went on, long-winded preacher as he was, a fellow fell out of the window, and guess what happened? They went in the third story, and he and everybody else evidently went down too and raised this guy up. Paul did. Then they went back up and partook. Now you tell me, if someone fell out of a third story window, do you think that would disrupt the service any? I think it might. So you have one assembly for the purpose of eating. Evidently, according to him, they didn't do it. And then you have them reassembling a second time and having a second service, according to him. Now, I don't believe that's an accurate assessment of the text. I'll show you why in a minute. But if what he asserts is true, then it's the very thing he's looking for. A second service with a second offering. Also, did you notice in verse 11 that only Paul partook? Look at verse 11 again. He says there, "And when he was gone up and had broken the bread and eaten." Now some might say, well, he, meaning Paul, was the one who did it and everyone else partook, but he's the one distributed. Well, that doesn't say that. It says he broke and ate. So only one person partook. But again, I don't think that is correct and a correct assessment of this. Why is that? Very simply, because in verse 7, the latter part, it says Paul intended to depart on the morrow. It says that he was intending to leave the next day. And when you look at this passage, he prolonged his speech and let me read just the latter part of verse 7. He intending to depart on the morrow and prolonged his speech until midnight. And then he goes on talking about how he went on after midnight. This fellow fell out of the window. Then Paul went down, raised him, came up and ate. And at daybreak, after daybreak, he left. Now, what does midnight mean? You remember Luke was a Gentile writer, inspired. But he's referring to the Roman time system. At midnight, just like with our midnight, you have a new day, don't you? And so you had them assemble on the first day to break bread. Midnight comes and goes. Paul keeps on preaching until this guy falls out the window. So it's sometime after midnight. Now Paul raises and comes up and eats. Is he partaking on first day of the week anymore, if it's the Lord's Supper? No, this would be a Monday observance. Well, that's not scriptural, is it? That's not what's being permitted here. So what you have is Monday morning, Paul, fixing to go on a long journey, eats a common meal. Don't you usually eat before you take a long trip? I know I do. And so what you see is verse 11 cannot be. According to his view, it would contradict him. But in context, it is not, verse 11, the Lord's Supper. Verse 7 is, but verse 11 is not. Now, you know, even though that won't necessarily answer his question on the point of a second offering, you know, obviously it doesn't show that because the second case of eating is a common meal. It just goes to show that he's reading into the text things that are not there. We also see an invalid comparison. Now, I know some try to sustain the point about the second offering by appealing to the Passover. I think that's a mistake. I don't think that that is a valid parallel. Some try to say, well, God permitted the Old Testament people a second opportunity in the year to partake of the Passover if they missed the first time. Yes, He did. But let's look at that in a little more detail. He uses this. He said if God wanted a makeup as He did the Passover in Numbers 9, He would have said so. And I think that's true. But I don't think it answers what He thinks it answers. Notice the Passover. What does that commandment involve? Well, it involves Exodus 12, Deuteronomy 13, Deuteronomy 16, the 14th day of Abib, the first month of the Hebrew calendar. First month, 14th day. Now, that's the day specified. So it's a once a year thing. And he says Deuteronomy 13 in its season or year by year. And so it's a yearly observance, which is not a problem. We understand it's a periodic observance. It's like a weekly observance is a periodic observance. That would be parallel in that point. But notice also, Deuteronomy 16:4 and verse 6 and in some other verses talks about observing the Passover at dusk or at even or at sunset. The specific time is identified even on that day. Do we have that specified in the Lord's Supper? No, we don't. Also, Deuteronomy 16, 5-6, this point might be parallel. He says you're only to do this at the appointed place or the place in which the Lord will choose. And he's talking about the tabernacle. When they would take the land, God would choose Jerusalem, and there the temple would be built. And that's where they would come together to do that. You could make the parallel of only in the assembly. Okay, that would be parallel. But here's another point that's not parallel. God gave a specified exception in Numbers chapter 9, 6-13. If certain people were unclean or on a long journey, they were hindered from partaking on the authorized day. What were they to do? He goes on to specify the next month on the 14th day they can do that. He authorized a new day in the next month. Of course, you need an exception if you're going to do it on a different time than what's authorized, don't you? He authorized one day out of the whole year in the first month, but if they want to do it on another day in another month, they need special authority for that. Otherwise, it's not authorized. Now, when we look at this, I want to highlight again, he identifies the time of day and gives a special exemption for another day in the next month, which is not done for the Lord's Supper. We also just want to highlight this. God specified the time of day for the Passover, but just the day for the Lord's Supper. I want to emphasize that. He said the time of day for the Passover, but the day, just the day. He does not ever specify time of day. Now, in Acts 20, we could make the argument, several made this comment this morning, I thought it was very observant of you, that they came together evidently in the evening. Now, if we were going to find things which are really incidentals, but they're in the example, they came together in the evening, should we only partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week in the evening? If not, why not? I think it's an incidental. It's not relevant to the command. Yes, that's when they came together in the evening. But does that mean that the command necessarily requires we come together only on the evening? No, because in verse 7, the command, as it's summarized, when upon the first day of the week, it didn't say at evening. If it did that, then it would be highlighted, wouldn't it? But it didn't highlight that. It said just upon the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, when we come together for this purpose, when we assemble for this purpose on the first day. Well, that statement in itself could be done at evening, as they did. One time in the evening, that could do it. Or you could do it twice, morning and evening, and that would fulfill the statement in Acts 20, verse 7. And so I believe that we see the point. The statement in Acts 20, verse 7, about when and their purpose of coming together is more generic than what we see compared to the Passover. We also see that God gave an exception for another day for the Passover, Numbers 9. But we never once see an exception for another day on the Lord's Supper. We don't see an exception permitting it to be done on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. And so we have no authority to do that. So this is a distinction between the Passover, and I believe that point of Numbers 9, the exception, is not parallel to what we're talking about. But let's ask the question. If I came, before you look at that, if I, under the Old Testament, was a Hebrew, and I came on the 14th of Abib, and someone came at, right at the beginning of the evening, evening, sometimes there's a little period where that sun hadn't quite gone all the way down, and someone comes 20 minutes later, and it's still evening, and then they start. Have they violated the command? Do they need special permission to take now? Because they didn't do it with everybody else at the same moment? No, it's still within that authorized time. Even within a narrow detail of the Old Testament law. But if they wanted to take it another time, they would need special permission. Now, the parallel would be, in the New Testament, do we need an exception to partake on Sunday? We could say, do we need an exception to take in the assembly? No, that's exactly what God authorized and exactly what God commanded. It's already authorized, therefore why would we need an exception? See, that's my whole point. They're trying to refute this as an attempt to prove an exception when I don't say it's an exception. I don't think we need an exception for what is already authorized. Now, let's look at some summary points very quickly. Brian Yeager's view, as quickly as I can go. Anyway, Brian Yeager's view. He says, in one letter on the 10th of this month, he says, yes, stating that the makeup serving of the Lord's Supper is without authority is saying it's sinful. Our brethren at Colonial Heights need to understand that. They say it's unauthorized, but they don't want to say it's sinful. At least he admits if it's unauthorized, it is sinful. He admits that. He's consistent, at least, on that. And he says, and carries consequences of fellowship with it. Colossians 3:17, we need to do all in the name of the Lord. We have authority for that. 2 John 9-11, we're not to have fellowship with those who teach error. And so obviously he says this is an issue we can draw lines of fellowship over. He says, I am consistent in this manner. Well, we might debate that considering some of his practices, but he understands. If he's going to say it's without authority, he's saying it's sinful, and he's willing to draw lines of fellowship over, condemn people over. And so I think this guy is very much, he's consistent, but he's wrong in this point. We also see, and I've got underlines there, I've got to put those in. We also see, he says, I skimmed through what you wrote and still haven't read what you wrote the first time through either. It is typical arguments made for things, here's his point again, unauthorized by all in error. What do you think he's saying about this? He's saying, if I can get my point here, it's unauthorized, it's sinful, it's error, and it's something that affects our fellowship. That's what he's saying. And so he's taking a very clear position on this. He also admits to not examining carefully replies to his view. He says, I skimmed through, and I still haven't read what you wrote the first time. Now you tell me, here's a gospel preacher. He says we're sinning by doing this, but he's not willing to take the time to even examine rebuttals to his view. Tell me, is that acceptable? I don't think so. I would fear God's judgment if someone said, you're wrong on this, here's the rebuttal to it, and I said, well, sorry, I'm not going to look at it. Wouldn't you fear judgment if somebody said that you were doing something sinful and they had scriptural support for their position, and then you didn't take the time to consider it? Hell yeah, it takes some work. Sometimes we don't see eye to eye right away. We need to be willing to study and examine things. Sometimes somebody might think we're sinning, and we're not. And it takes a lot of time, and sometimes they won't see the truth on the matter. And we'll have to deal with that. But just on the basic first point, we need to be willing to give an answer, give it a response to the things that we believe. Doesn't 1 Peter 3 say that? We need to be ready always to give an answer, to give it a defense for the things that we believe. And here, he's willing to say his side of the story, but he's not willing to take time to examine carefully rebuttals to his view. He goes on to say, if you want to study this, come on down and study it, and we can study it face to face. Now, that sounds like an invitation, doesn't it? Well, notice this. If you study face to face in April, believe me, I plan to educate you well then anyway. That is, unless you run and cancel the meeting. Does that sound a little arrogant to you? Believe me, I plan to educate you on this. Now, he's not willing to listen to the rebuttal, but he's willing to teach me what for. Does that sound like the attitude a gospel preacher needs to have? He at least needs to be willing to listen before he answers, right? There's a proverb that talks something about that. That it's folly, it's a fool to answer before you even hear what someone has to say. It's foolishness. And yet he, as a gospel preacher, decides that that's what he's going to do. We go on, he says, you probably sit back and read what you write and say, huh, I got him there. Typo was his. But I'm not against typos, I'll make them all the time. But here he's accusing me of sitting back saying, ha, got him here. And yeah, I got a good argument here. Yeah, I got him. Yeah. That's what he's accusing me of. The guy doesn't even know me. The guy doesn't even know me. I don't know him other than his writings here. And here he is saying this about me. Now, is that character assassination or what? Assuming evil in a brother or what? But he says, that's probably what you like. And if in this venue we wanted this discussion, you'll have to find someone else. You want to write and discuss this issue? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'll come and I'll teach you, but I'm not going to discuss it through written format. He says, I do not believe in fighting unarmed men. Now, when you look at my arguments, you may not agree with every argument. You might see a hole here and there. But at least show me where I'm unarmed. If you think I'm unarmed, show me where you think I'm unarmed. Don't just assert that I'm unarmed. That is not a jab. Yes, it is. Just the truth. I believe arguments and the answering of such is like... To me, that's kind of a crass statement, but I just want you to see what kind of person this guy is. That's very crass. It's very crass. And here's a guy who says he's a gospel preacher. Again, Brian Yeager's view. Compare this to Titus 3, verses 10 and 11. A factious, that word means divisive man. After a first and second admonition, I've written him two or three times, same results. A factious man after a first and second admonition refused, knowing that such a one is perverted and sinneth, being self-condemned. Now, you can look at the evidence yourself, and there's more evidence than what I put up here. Does it look like he's condemning himself in his relationship with God? I would say yes. When you look at Matthew 7, 15 through 17, it says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Presents himself as a gospel preacher, but when it gets down to it, is he willing to present the gospel in the way the Lord wants him to present it? Preach just the gospel or preach his opinions? And when it gets down to it and he's challenged in his view and his opinion, what does he do? He lashes out. Is that really the sign of a sheep or a wolf? When they bare the teeth and they sink them in. I don't remember sheep having fangs, do you? He says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. By their fruits you shall know them. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Now, when you compare the way he's taught, what he's taught, and his attitude about it, would you say that's a good fruit, or would you say that's some kind of thorn or thistle? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but the corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. Which one would he be categorized as? Our application is this. We saw this chart before, and maybe I need to be more clear in some of my points, but you know, we can talk about it at least. Some assert that it is a sin and refuse to fellowship any who do it. That's pretty close to Brian Yeager's position. But is that the correct position? I would assert that it is not. Some assert that it is unauthorized but do not want to say it is sinful or in fellowship. They're inconsistent. If it's unauthorized, it's sinful and we shouldn't have fellowship with it. But if it is authorized, how can you say it's not? See, I don't believe that's a scriptural position either. And the point about leaving it to personal judgment, I would urge us to consider and to study and understand that when the Lord commands us to do something, we need to do that. We need to understand that if the Lord requires it of us, how can we leave it up to personal judgment? And again, when we come across something like this, perhaps we haven't studied this before, or perhaps we have and we haven't settled our minds on it yet, there's time to study and there's time to comprehend and understand. You know, in Romans 14, evidently there was a lot of problems there where brethren were having some conflict, evidently. And Paul settles the conflict down, tells them not to judge one another. He teaches them what the truth is on me so that they would have a proper concept and learn where to keep their conscience and the proper check and boundary so that they can work together in harmony with the truth, not violating the truth in any way, and not treating each other in any way they shouldn't, and work things through. And so if we're not on that page yet where we are able to understand and work together within the boundaries of God's Word, there's a place for learning and studying together. But I just want to highlight that I don't think that that is a scriptural position, because I believe that point B is what God has authorized, and that is that we are to partake and that we are to make arrangements so that others who missed are to partake as well. And again, if there's questions, we can continue to study and look at this. But obviously, we know point A and B is obviously not true. And we could talk more if you have questions or comments about point C. But in proving point D, I believe that all others are refuted. And in proving that, we see that the conclusion is that while all things must be authorized, everything we teach, practice, do must find some Bible authority. Not reading into the text, but understanding God must authorize it before we have permission to do it. But that does not mean that all things are specifically authorized. And I think we've seen that today, and I think we all agree on that principle, that not everything is specifically authorized. We may not yet see eye to eye in every detail of what is specifically unspecified but still authorized, but we can work that out and we can understand that better as time goes on. Basically, general authority permits unspecified things which fulfill the command. And that's the point. General authority permits things that are not specifically stated when they allow us to fulfill the command. And that's what we need to understand is the point about the second offering. I believe that that is not specifically permitted, but it is generally permitted because the authority is for the first day in the assembly for that purpose, to come together and take the Lord's Supper. Those who bind unspecified details, like Brian Yeager, who will say that, well, it cannot be done this way. We forbid it from being done this way. It's a sin if you do it this way. He's binding one way of doing it to the exclusion of the other, which is all acceptable to God, I believe. And so we see that those who bind unspecified details must read into the text, misdefine words, and make invalid parallels to prove their point. And we're warned against such a position, such a stance, that it is not one that God would have us to fall into and follow after. And we know that we can't follow fellowship false teachers. Many passages we looked at a few moments ago, the passage after passage after passage tells us that if someone teaches another gospel, they're taking a position that God has not permitted them to take. And so we need to be careful of those who teach false doctrine and try to get us to do things that we are not authorized to do, or that are violating God's law. Now, when we look at this, you know, we'll have to make a decision. We'll talk together as the men, and I trust that you will make a decision based upon Scripture. And I've tried to present the evidence fairly. I mean, if there's some debate on whether a quote was in context or not, you can have the whole thing. And you can see for yourself the context in which these things were said. I don't have a problem with that. I'm not ashamed of anything that I've written on this matter, or the length of which I've written, or anything of that matter. And if we are patient, and we'll consider these evidences and things and weigh them out, I believe that we can come in time to a complete and good understanding together upon what the truth is. Well, I hope that these lessons this morning and this evening have been edifying to you. I know sometimes newer topics can raise a lot of questions when we first address them. And sometimes we might say, well, he didn't talk about this aspect or that aspect, or I have this objection. He didn't address that. Well, we're limited in the amount of time that we can cover. But if you have any concerns, any questions whatsoever on this, feel free. We'll sit down. We'll talk about it as brethren. We'll work through it. And we want to come together based upon truth, upon what God has revealed. And upon that basis, we can have unity and fellowship together and work together in the way of the Lord. This evening, if anyone needs to respond to the gospel, either in becoming a Christian, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Have you done that? If you have, and you find that your life has not been what it should be, perhaps you've been wandering away from the Lord, drifting from Him, letting something maybe private sink into your life and pull away your heart and your faithfulness from Him. And maybe nobody else knows about that, but God will always know. He's the one that we need to face in the final judgment. Make yourself right with Him while we stand and while we sing.